Welcome to another midweek lesson from Grace Christian Assembly. Open your Bible and join us as we dig into the Word. Now, here's our teacher, Jim McLarty.
We are technically in Deuteronomy 2 tonight, but we may not get there. So. Well, that's what you get for starting to flip so quickly. I've got a couple of things I'd like to talk about before we actually get to Deuteronomy. And you know, my rule is, and I like this rule, the guy with the microphone gets to talk about whatever he wants. I like that rule. We are in an interesting season of the year. Twice a year, I just become a little more anxious and difficult than I am the rest of the year. That week leading up to Easter is always problematic for me. And that week leading up to Christmas is always problematic for me, simply because of the apoplexy that the world goes through because of these two Christian holidays. And then also the way that the church world just basks in Babylonish customs and traditions while giving absolutely no thought to what they're doing or why they're doing it. I don't know if any of you drove up this way, up Hazelwood, as you were coming, but the Methodists down the street, who consistently have the sign that makes me want to reply every week, their sign right now says, "We are Easter people living in a Good Friday world." Exactly. Exactly. That makes you go, huh? Because of a couple of things. First off, I just personally have a difficulty, this is just me, but I have a difficulty referring to the single most important event in human history, the resurrection of Christ, by the name of an ancient goddess. Yep. That just causes me a form of cognitive dissonance because I can't hold both those ideas in my head at once. I can't say Christ resurrected, the single most important thing to ever happen on the planet, and I will refer to that event by the name of Ishtar. And yet the whole church world does it without giving it a second thought. And then secondarily, Good Friday. Good Friday was stamped onto the church during the Constantinian period when the Easter Ishtar celebration became an amalgam of holidays that included the Christian observance of the resurrection. And so the name was stamped onto it. I don't know if any of you watched the news this week. The more things change, the more they stay the same. But did you read about the hubbub in Davenport, Iowa? Yeah. Because the city council there, though they want to still give the employees Good Friday off, no longer want to call it Good Friday, because that has religious connotations and overtones. And in a case of political correctness run amok, they've said, well, separation of church and state, so let's still take the holiday off, but let's call it the spring holiday. Okay, now, here's where it's interesting. Originally, it was the spring holiday. Originally, the Feast of Ishtar was a fertility feast to this goddess, also known as Semiramis, but it's a fertility feast, which is why it was celebrated with symbols of fertility like rabbits and eggs. Do I need to spell that out? Rabbits and eggs are both signs of fertility. Anybody who's ever owned a couple of rabbits knows that if you have two rabbits and don't check closely, soon you will have bunches of rabbits. So the spring fertility feast that went by the name of the Ishtar Feast also included a day of celebration to the god Freya, and that happened on Freya's Day. Freya's Day is the etymological root of our English word Friday. And so in order to make the crucifixion scenario fit the Babylonish spring feast calendar, Christ was said to die on a Friday and raise on Sunday morning. because the feast, which was already established in Rome at the time, had a celebration on Friday and had a celebration on Sunday morning, and it was a sunrise festival because, after all, the Ishtar feast was a sun feast. It was the beginning of spring, and the days were getting longer, and the crops were going to grow, and the sun was back, winter was over, and it was all about the continual rebirth of the unconquered sun, S-U-N. So it wasn't a huge leap to make it the resurrection of the unconquered S-O-N. It was really easy to stamp the Christian notion on there. Now, it's true biblically that Christ raised on the first day of the week. We know that. But the first day of the week started Saturday at sundown. When the women came to the tomb, while it was still dark, before the dawn, they did not come watch him rise. They got there and the tomb was empty. He was already up. He rose any time after sundown Saturday night, because that was his 72 hours. He'd been there 3 days, three nights. So we don't really know when he got up, but we know for sure he did not get up at sunrise. But the Ishtar feast, you go out and celebrate the rising of the sun, the return of the sun. And so churches all over the world this Sunday are going to have sunrise services for Easter with bunny rabbits and eggs for the kids. The big mega church in Murfreesboro has been advertising it for weeks. Come see the Easter bunny at our Easter festival. So it's tremendously ironic to me that a feast that started out a spring feast was stamped with Christianity, and then Christianity was molded in order to make it fit the pagan feast, which always, by the way, seems to be the case. You never see the pagan feast adjust to Christianity. But Christianity has a long history of being adjusted to fit the pagan schedules. That's what happened at Christmas, what happens at Easter. So it's just interesting that in Davenport, they said, we don't want to call it Good Friday, so let's call it Spring Holiday. Well, that's what it was. Go ahead and just call it that. But, oh, these people who are so politically correct and say, oh, we can't call it Good Friday, that's too Christian. Because they actually think that that pagan festival, which has been stamped with Christianity, now our common mindset is that it is Christian, and now people are offended by how Christian it is and want to take it back to its pagan roots. The more things change, the more they stay the same. All right, there's that.
They had to back off of that, though. Because
they did.
The contract said Good Friday.
Right.
And so they wouldn't.
Their contract said Good Friday, and the labor unions were afraid they'd lose their holiday, so they're still calling it Good Friday. They had to back away from it. Yeah. It's just interesting that every year around the holidays, you see these kind of discussions and these kind of arguments, just like at Christmas, whether they could have manger scenes on, you know, public lands or parks or anything. These arguments always come up. Okay, now, the last couple of days, I wrote a new Q&A that is going to Jeff that will be on our website soon. And I have a history and a habit of reading these Q&As after I've written them. People listen much more than they read. And so I'm going to read this, and then no one can say of our listening audience that they weren't aware that I had responded to this. Turn to Matthew 24:34. Matthew 24:34 is a favorite verse of critics of the Bible and equally a favorite verse of preterists. Do you know what I mean when I use the word preterist? Preterism is a hermeneutic for reading the Bible. It is an eschatological scheme that essentially concludes that everything predicted, and I mean everything predicted in the Bible, was wrapped up at 70 AD. There's nothing left. Christ came back in 70 AD. The destruction of Jerusalem and the temple was the return of Christ in judgment. 70 AD, it's all finished. A consistent full preterist will not even take the Lord's Supper anymore because the kingdom is here. It's now. It's been here ever since 70 AD. Most consistent preterists, sometimes they're called hyper-preterists, they'll go so far as to say, we're living in the new age, we're living in the new world, the new heavens and earth is now. As of 70 AD, everything's wrapped up. There's no prophecy left to be fulfilled at all. Then there is a position called moderate preterist, which are folks who see a return of Christ yet to come in the future. However, they still say that everything prophetically was wrapped up in 70 AD. Some very well-known folk hold to that position, like R.C. Sproul or Hank Hanegraaff, the Bible Answer Man. They hold to this partial preterist position. Well, preterism is based in an emphasis on particular key verses out of context, particularly the verses that have time statements in them. They become very argumentative about the time statements. And Matthew 24, 34 is a classic example of a verse that preterists will argue with you about endlessly. And critics of the Bible will argue, the critic will argue that what Jesus said in Matthew 24, 34 did not come true. And since it didn't come true, Jesus doesn't know what he's talking about. And if he was wrong in this instance, then where else was he wrong? Therefore, he's not trustworthy, the Bible's not trustworthy, the whole thing falls down like a house of cards. So let's start by reading Matthew 24, 34. You got it there, Carol?
Yes.
What does it say?
Verily I say unto you, this generation shall not pass till all these things be fulfilled.
So Jesus, in Matthew 24, one of the great eschatological passages of the Gospels, he's been asked a couple of questions. He's been talking about the temple. You see all these stones, not one of them is going to be standing on another. He talks about the destruction of the temple, and they ask him, when will these things be, and what will be the sign of your coming? And so he's answering their questions. And then as he's describing not only the destruction of the temple, but the sign of his return, and signs in the heavens, the unqualified, unmissable return of Christ, he says, and this generation will not pass until all these things are fulfilled. On the surface, you could read that and go, well, wait a minute. If Jesus was speaking to the people who were alive at that moment as he was speaking, and then said, this generation won't pass till this is all fulfilled, if a generation is 40 years, then yes, the destruction of Jerusalem did happen within a generation of Jesus saying these things. But that would also mean that everything else in Matthew 24 would have to have come to its fruition by 70 AD, or that generation did pass and not all of this happened. See the argument? And on the surface, if you're not ready for it, that can be a really compelling and confusing argument. That's why I wrote this Q&A, so that at least the GCA folk, not the Tomites, but at least the GCA folk will be prepared the next time someone says, well, you know, Jesus said that the generation he was talking to would not pass until all those things were fulfilled. So you either have to admit that Jesus was wrong, or you have to admit that everything he said in Matthew 24 was fulfilled by 70 AD. Those are your only two options, given the language. Turns out there's a third option. It requires something I like to call exegesis, actually paying attention to the words in the text. That's why I wrote this Q&A. The question came in, hey, Jim, I was reading Matthew, and I hit 24:34, and I was having trouble with that verse. In context, it seems that Christ is telling his disciples that he would return before the end of, quote, this generation. Or is he speaking of something different being fulfilled? I know eschatology is your specialty, so I was hoping that you could shed some light on this verse. And I replied, I don't know if I would say that eschatology is my specialty, but it has certainly been an area of interest for some time. Nonetheless, I get nervous anytime anyone claims some level of expertise in the Bible. We're all just learning as we go. Over the years, Matthew 24:34 has been hotly debated by critics of the Bible, as well as interpreters and students of Scripture. But I think the wrinkles can be ironed out with a bit of etymological investigation and word study. The debate revolves around Jesus saying, quote, this generation shall not pass till all these things be fulfilled. That's the King James Version. Or as the NASB renders it, truly I say to you, this generation will not pass away until all these things take place. To the critic, this verse is a prime example of biblical error, since many aspects of what Jesus described failed to occur in the lifetimes of those to whom he was speaking. The critic argues that the generation alive as Jesus spoke did not witness his return or the signs in the heavens. Therefore, Jesus was wrong. And if Jesus was wrong, then all of Christianity is suspect because it is prone to error. But as I mentioned, a bit of word study will demonstrate that the problem stems from a misunderstanding of the word generation. But first, let me add a common, plausible explanation to Matthew 24:34. Some defenders of Scripture argue that this generation refers back to the people being addressed in the previous verse. Matthew 24:33 says, "So you too, when you see all these things, recognize that he is near, right at the door." And that's grammatically possible. In that case, Jesus would be saying that the generation that saw the signs beginning would see the whole thing come to its fruition. Then it would be tied to his comment earlier in Matthew 24:22, where he said, "For the elect's sake, those days will be shortened." But the critic will respond that such an interpretation leads to a nonsensical conclusion. Jesus would be saying that the generation alive at that time would be alive at that time. So what's the big deal? And I see their point. In Matthew 24:34, Jesus appears to be speaking of the endurance or the continuation of this generation, not merely some future generation yet to come. So that brings us back to examining the words themselves, along with their context, in order to really understand what Jesus was saying. And as we'll see, the resolution of the matter has to do with how we treat the word generation. One difficulty we have as 21st century Americans is that our language is a mishmash of various languages. English is an amalgam of Greek, Latin, Celtic, French, German, and various other languages and dialects as diverse as the people who immigrated to our shores and brought their terminology with them. As words are added to our lexicon, their definitions are determined by their usage. Our dictionaries are constantly updating and adding words according to their most common understanding. So, our understanding of words changes over time. For instance, back in 1611, when the King James Version was being translated, the word "let" meant to restrain. We still hear that meaning of the word during tennis matches, when a ball hits the net. It's called a let ball. But the most common understanding of "let" today is to allow. So if you let your children have lunch, you allow them to eat. You don't restrain them. So it's confusing to the modern reader when they encounter a verse such as this in the King James. 2 Thessalonians 2:7 says, "For the mystery of iniquity does already work. Only he who now letteth will let until he is taken out of the way." The common understanding of the word "let" would lead the reader to the exact opposite conclusion of Paul's original meaning. It was the proper word choice in 1611, but it's a confusing choice today. The meaning of words changes over time according to common usage and common understanding. So, when doing biblical exegesis, we need to concentrate on what the original Greek words meant, how they were used, and how the translators understood the English words they used to represent the original Greek words. And we must always remember that some English words that used to have diverse meanings have become singular focus words through repetition of that primary meaning, such is the case with the word generation. In years past, it had a much wider scope of meaning than is assumed today. For instance, the venerable church father Jerome argued that in Matthew 24:34, Jesus was referring to future offspring. He wrote, "By generation here, he, Jesus, means the whole human race and the Jews in particular." And he adds, "Heaven and earth shall pass away, but my word shall not pass away," to confirm their faith in what has gone before. As though he had said, it is easier to destroy things solid and immovable than that ought should fail of my words. Jerome felt that the word generation meant future offspring. In saying that, Jerome was employing a common, then well-known translation of the Greek word genea. He understood it to mean future offspring of a common ancestor. And that makes sense when you consider the etymology of the Greek word. Genea is the same word that lies at the root of genealogy. In fact, genealogy is spelled G-E-N-E-A, which is the exact spelling of the Greek word genea. So when we talk about a genealogy, we're talking about the offspring, or the genea, from a common root. According to Ado's Dictionary of Word Origins, the base word, G-E-N, denotes produce, and it results in words like genesis, genre, generation, and genus. The root word points to types, such as types of people or commonality in production. So generation originally denoted people of common ancestry. That meaning of the Greek word is also represented in Thayer's Greek-English Lexicon of the New Testament, which provides the following definitions. Number one, a begetting, a birth, a nativity. Number two, that which has been begotten, men of the same stock or a family. 2a, a subdivision there, the several ranks of natural descent, the successive members of a genealogy. 2b, metaphorically, a race of men very like each other in endowments, pursuits, or character. And number three, the whole multitude of men living at the same time, used especially of the Jewish race living at one and the same period. And number four, an age, i.e. the time ordinarily occupied by each successive generation. Likewise, Strong's Greek Dictionary of the New Testament reads, a generation, by implication, an age or a period of persons, an age, a generation, a nation, or a time. Notice that one of the primary definitions of genea has to do with a group of people of common descent. It also denotes a nation. And that is the meaning that Jesus appears to have had in mind when he employed that word. So now let's look at word usage for a moment. In the King James Version, genea is translated generation 37 times, time twice, age twice, and nation only once. But when the King James Version was translated, a people of common descent was one of the listed meanings of the English word generation. Even though our modern Merriam-Webster's dictionary does not list this as a possible meaning, the 1908 Webster's Dictionary provides this definition. Number six, race, kind, family, breed, stock. Remember what I said earlier? Through common usage, as our dictionaries are updated, they refer to the most common current use of the word. But generation used to mean something quite different than it means today. And the Random House College Dictionary 1968 version includes the offspring of a certain parent or couple considered as a step in natural descent. Despite the fact that most modern folk read the word generation and think only of an immediate group of people, those living at any one time, the meaning of common ancestry or a nation of people was well known and consistently employed during the time when the King James Version was being translated. For instance, when William Shakespeare penned these words from his play The Life of Timon of Athens in Act 1, Scene 1, he used the term generation to exhibit common ancestry. He wrote, "Thy mother's of my generation. What is she if I be a dog?" Now, he was not saying, "Your mother and I are of the same generation," because she was older than him, if we mean generation by the common terminology. He meant, we're of the same ancestry. And if I'm a dog, what's your mother? I like that Shakespeare was willing to make your mama jokes. All right, back to what I wrote. Now, here's the rub, a bit of Shakespearean humor there. Most of our modern translations of the Bible have also rendered genea as generation without helping us understand the distinction between its various meanings. Nevertheless, Kenneth Woost, in his expanded translation of the New Testament, renders Matthew 24:34 like this: "Assuredly, I am saying to you, this nation shall by no means pass away until all these things take place." Likewise, the New Testament, in the language of today, published in 1964 by William F. Beck, reads, "I tell you the truth, these people will not pass away until all this happens." So when we read the New Testament, it's best to keep in mind that the word generation has not always meant what we assume it to mean today. In fact, offspring, nation, or people of a common descent are perfectly acceptable translations of genea. And sometimes that meaning is obvious from the context of certain biblical passages. For instance, Luke 16:8 says, "And the Lord commended the unjust steward because he had done wisely. For the children of this world are, in their generation, wiser than the children of light." That's the King James Version. Was Jesus saying that the children of the world were only wise in that particular place and time? Or was he saying that they were wiser in their dealings with each other? Given the parable that he was presenting, it's much more likely that Jesus was talking about the interaction of worldly people among themselves as compared to how the children of light conduct themselves. And that's how the New American Standard Bible also understands Jesus' words. They render that verse, "And his master praised the unrighteous manager because he had acted shrewdly, for the sons of this age are more shrewd in relation to their own kind, genea, than the sons of light." In this instance, the word genea is expressing people of a common descent, not people living in a particular time period. Or consider Mark 8:12. "And he sighed deeply in his spirit and saith, Why doth this generation seek after a sign? Verily I say unto you, there shall no sign be given unto this generation." Was Jesus accusing only the people living at that moment of seeking a sign? Isn't that indictment just as true of people today, who insist that they want evidence of Christ or God before they will believe? The solution is to understand that Jesus was speaking of Israel, the people of common descent among whom he had spent his ministry. Those people demanded a sign from him, and he would provide a sign, the sign of Jonah, which, by the way, occurred, his death, burial, and resurrection, during that generation, if generation means period of time. So when he says, "No sign will be given to this generation," and then he turns around and fulfills the sign of Jonah, was he contradicting himself?
Good point.
And that wasn't even in the text, and I have to go back and rewrite this now to include that point.
Good point.
Oh. The solution is to understand that Jesus was speaking of Israel, the people of common descent among whom he had spent his ministry. Those people demanded a sign from him, and he would provide a sign, the sign of Jonah. But he provided that sign for the world, not just Israel, whom he identified as this generation. And that brings us full circle. The most biblically and historically consistent understanding of Matthew 24:34 is that Jesus was declaring the ongoing existence of Israel until all the things he had prophesied came to their completion. And, no surprise, he's right. To this very day, as we await the fulfillment of his words, the nation of Israel remains, and the people of Jewish descent, the offspring of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, are both present and identifiable on the earth. In other words, far from being an example of biblical error, when it's rightly understood, Matthew 24:34 is a shining example of God's faithfulness to his own word. Despite the fearsome things Christ described in his discourse in Matthew 24, he comforted his Jewish disciples by assuring them that they would endure, and just as all the Old Testament prophets said of Israel, God will continue to protect them until the day of their gathering and restoration. Jesus was simply saying what the Word of God had always said right up until that time. Does that clear it up for you?
Yep.
Did that help? Was that worth the half hour it took?
Yes.
Okay.
I would just answer that by saying Jesus has quoted all of these prophets.
That's what he's done. He's quoting prophets.
Oh, well,
and he's bringing all of that into focus.
Right, where it is only.
Where they are in that progress. And then saying, and don't worry, this people of common descent will continue till this is all taken care of.
Right, and he even explains that in the Old Testament.
Yes.
That as long as there is a sun, moon, and stars,
and waves in the sea,
Israel will be a nation.
Israel will continue to be a nation before him. It's Jeremiah 31 you're quoting. Jesus is simply saying the same thing that the scriptures had said right up until he said it. So, my point is, far from being a verse that undermines scripture,
it shows
how consistent it is.
Fine-tuned.
How fine-tuned it is, yes, exactly. Deuteronomy 2, turn there real quickly. Was that worth it? Was it worth going through? Okay. I hope so. I hope that's a help to you. And I hope it's a help to the folks listening on the internet, because, like I said, that is a favorite verse of the biblical critics. And it's not that difficult to respond to. Now people can go to our website, print out that Q&A, hand it to the critic and say, there, now go away. So. Deuteronomy chapter 2 is a continuation of Moses recounting everything that had happened to Israel since the Exodus out of Egypt. The vast majority of this chapter is very straightforward historical recounting of what happened. But the one thing I want to emphasize is one more time the sovereignty of God comes shining through as Moses emphasizes this time not only God's control and command of Israel nationally, but the other people groups who own the property through which Israel traveled, some of whom God said, wipe them out and take their land, and others God said, don't touch them, and even if you take their food, you have to pay them. So God was in tremendous control of the heathen nations and of Israel, and who got what land, and who got to keep land, and who lost land. Very much like what we read throughout the scripture, God saying that he raises up one and he takes down another, and he raises up nations and he brings up kings, and he can bring up Nebuchadnezzar as easily as he can make Nebuchadnezzar crazy. He can make Babylon great, and he can overthrow it in a night when the Medo-Persians come in. So, again, we're going to see that exampled here, or demonstrated here. Is exampled a word? Here we're going to see that demonstrated again as Moses recounts their traveling. Chapter 2 of the book of Deuteronomy. I had someone this week on Facebook, just to show they listened to last week, spell out phonetically one word. Sent me a Facebook message that only said Deuteronomy. They're listening. Then we turned and set out for the wilderness by the way of the Red Sea, as the Lord spoke to me, and circled Mount Seir for many days. And the Lord spoke to me, saying, you have circled this mountain long enough. Turn north and command the people, saying, you will pass through the territory of your brothers, the sons of Esau, who live in Seir, and they will be afraid of you, so be very careful. How does God know that they will be very afraid of them? Well, by the time you get to the end of this chapter, God's going to say, Moses recounts God saying that he is going to put the fear of Israel on all the surrounding nations. So again, the sovereignty of God, as he puts fear into the hearts of heathens, so that his people are able to move through their territories and take their land. So you're going to pass through the territory of your brother, sons of Esau, who live in Seir. They'll be afraid of you, so be careful, do not provoke them. For I will not give you any of their land, not as much as a footstep, because I've given Mount Seir to Esau as a possession. Isn't that interesting? Verse 6, you shall buy food from them with money so that you may eat, and you shall also purchase water from them with money so that you may drink. For the Lord your God has blessed you in all that you have done, and he has known your wanderings through this great wilderness. These 40 years the Lord your God has been with you. You have not lacked a thing. So we passed beyond our brothers, the sons of Esau, who live in Seir, away from the Arabah road, away from Elath and from Ezion-Geber, and we turned and passed through by the way of the wilderness of Moab. Then the Lord said to me, do not harass Moab. Do not provoke them to war, for I will not give you any of their land as a possession, because I have given Ar to the sons of Lot for a possession. Do you know what territory we're talking about now? Remember Abraham and Lot going up on a mountain? Abraham said, choose. Whichever way you go, I'll go the other way. And Lot looked down at the green, fertile land and said, that seems good by me. I'll take the good, green, fertile land. Abraham agreed and said, you take that land, I'll go the other way. Little did Lot know that he picked the land of Sodom and Gomorrah. It looked good, but he ended up having to run for it. But he settled there in that valley. And to this day, God said, I gave that to Lot. Remember when Abraham was on the mountain and let Lot choose? God says, I'm defending that choice. That's still his land. So don't take anything from him. The Emim lived there formerly, says verse 10, a people as great, numerous, and tall as the Anakim. Like the Anakim, they are also regarded as Rephaim. But the Moabites call them Emim. That language gets confusing. Anakim, giants. These were the ones that when the spies went into the land, they came back afraid and said, there's giants in the land. So we were like grasshoppers, very tall people. The Rephaim, or they're called the Rapha, these were warrior people. These were not only big, but these were big, mean warrior people. So what God's warning them of is the tall people, the Anakim, are in there. They are also regarded as Rephaim, which means warrior people. But the local Moabites call them Emim. So we're talking about one people group who go by several different names. The Horites formerly lived in Seir, but the sons of Esau dispossessed them and destroyed them from before them and settled in their place, just as Israel did to the land of their possession, which the Lord gave them. That's a little comment that Moses just throws in there to let us know the history of the land where now the Moabites and then the Esauites were living. So Moses gives us the lay of the land. Verse 13, now arise and cross over the brook Zered yourselves. So we crossed over the brook Zered. Now the time that it took for us to come from Kadesh Barnea until we crossed over the brook Zered was 38 years, until all the generation of the men of war perished from within the camp, as the Lord had sworn to them. Moreover, the hand of the Lord was against them to destroy them from within the camp until they all perished. So it came about, when all the men of war had finally perished from among the people, that the Lord spoke to me, saying, you shall cross over Ar, the border of Moab, today. And when you come opposite the sons of Ammon, do not harass them nor provoke them, for I will not give you any of the land of the sons of Ammon as a possession, because I have given it to the sons of Lot as a possession. It is also regarded as the land of the Rephaim, for Rephaim formerly lived in it, but the Ammonites call them Zemzumin, which is a name I am glad has fallen out of common usage. Not a lot of kids these days named Zemzumin. They are people as great and numerous and tall as the Anakim, but the Lord destroyed them before them. Moses brings that up, by the way, in order to prepare the children of Israel for the fact that they're on their way into Canaan, and that the spies had come out and said, there's really tall bad guys in there. Now he's recounting backwards and saying, now, you know, the Lord was with our brethren. They were with the Esauites, and they beat up on the big, tall warrior people. And then he's saying here that the Rephaim were once upon a time in the land of Ammon, which is the land that he gave to Lot. And they were great and numerous and tall as the Anakim, but the Lord destroyed them before them. And they dispossessed them and settled in their place. So Moses is really trying to build up the confidence of the Israelites and saying, we can take them. If God's with us, it doesn't matter that they're big. Just as he did for the sons of Esau who live in Seir, and he destroyed the Horites from among them, and they dispossessed them and settled in their place even to this day. And the Avim, who lived in villages as far as Gaza, and the Kaphtorim, who came from Kaphtor, destroyed them and lived in their place. Arise, set out, and pass through the valley of Arnon. Look, I have given Sihon the Amorite, king of Heshbon, and his land into your hand. Begin to take possession and contend with him in battle. This day I will begin to put the dread and the fear of you upon the peoples everywhere under heaven, who, when they hear the report of you, shall tremble and be in anguish because of you. Now, to me, this is just fascinating. You could read through this chapter and miss it completely. But God just said, now, don't touch these people. I'm not going to give you anything of theirs. If you take food or water, pay them for it. You don't get even a footstep of their land. And oh yeah, these over here, don't touch them. Mostly because they're brethren, they're related. So he's saying, don't touch them, don't touch them. I've given them their land. They went in, they conquered, they took care of the giants, they've possessed their land, and you can't have it. I've given it to them. Then he says, now, as for these people, wipe them out and take their stuff. Take their land, take their cities. And on top of that, to make it easier on you, I have put the dread of you into the minds and hearts of those people before you even get there. So when you get there to war, they're already afraid of you. Do you see the sovereignty here? This is God guaranteeing that his people get the possession that he has promised them. And he's taken care of putting fear in the hearts of his enemies. He's taken care of making sure that they're a nation that's strong and ready to war. He's taken care of providing for them with clothes that don't wear out, shoes that don't wear out, bread from heaven to eat every day. They've had everything they need to go and get the land now, and God's in complete charge of it. This is why I say things like I did on Sunday, like a God who can do this can handle your gas bill. I mean, this is a God who is moving nations of people around to accomplish his will. Verse 26. I sent messengers from the wilderness of Kedemoth to Sihon, king of Heshbon, with words of peace, saying, let me pass through your land. I will travel only on the highway. I will not turn aside to the right or to the left. You will send me food for money so that I may eat, and give me water for money so that I may drink. Only let me pass through on foot. Just as the sons of Esau who live in Seir and the Moabites who live in Ar did for me until I cross over the Jordan into the land which the Lord our God is giving us. However, verse 30, but Sihon the king of Heshbon was not willing for us to pass through his land. We could stop right there and say, well, it turns out that the king of Heshbon, of his own free will, of his own decision-making ability, decided that he was not going to cooperate with us. Look at the rest of what Moses wrote. For the Lord your God hardened his spirit and made his heart obstinate in order to deliver him into your hand as he is today. Now he's writing this after the fact. You may recall that at the end of the book of Numbers, they had already gone in and conquered this area. They'd already taken over these cities and they had already waylaid the king of Sihon. And every soldier of Israel came back. There were no deaths in that war, as you may recall. And so Moses brings that up again and says, now the reason that all happened, on the surface, to anybody looking, it would appear that the king just decided not to cooperate. But remember, this is Moses who was told at the burning bush to go tell Pharaoh, let my people go. And God said, he's not going to let them go because I'm going to harden his heart. And so this becomes Moses' frame of reference. And when he deals with the king of Sihon, who refuses to let them come through, even though he knows it is God's will that they go through, and even though he knows that God has already said, you're going to get his land, then Moses turns it all over to God's sovereignty and says, now the reason he didn't cooperate was because God hardened him so that we would come take his land. Is the God of the Bible able to do such things?
He does.
He does. And does your theology, I ask again, is your theology able to embrace a God who acts like this? Who will harden the hearts of kings so that they will be destroyed, so that his chosen people get what used to belong to that king? That's how God works. But Sihon, king of Heshbon, was not willing for us to pass through his land, for the Lord your God hardened his spirit and made his heart obstinate in order to deliver him into your hand as he is today. And the Lord said to me, see, I have begun to deliver Sihon and his land over to you. Begin to occupy that you may possess his land. Then Sihon, with all his people, came out to meet us in the battle of Jahaz. And the Lord, our God, delivered him over to us, and we defeated him with his sons and all his people. So we captured all his cities at that time and utterly destroyed the men and the women and the children of every city. We left no survivor. We took only the animals as our booty and the spoil of the cities which we had captured. From Aroer, which is on the edge of the valley of Arnon, and from the city which is in the valley, even to Gilead, there was no city that was too high for us. The Lord our God delivered all over to us. Only you did not go near to the sons of Ammon, all along the river Jabbok, or the cities of the hill country, or wherever the Lord our God had commanded us. Out of the whole Bible. Or I should back up and put it this way. Once upon a time, there was a young man who used to sit here in the second row on Wednesday nights. He's moved since then. And he had come out of a very Arminian background, a very free will background. And one day, God flipped whatever that switch was in his brain that made him see and understand the sovereignty of God. And he came in here one night beside himself, like he was the first one to ever see this. And he came in and he said, okay, it turns out in the Bible, God's in like complete control. And I said, right. That's why we use the word sovereign so much around here. That's why we talk about a grace of a sovereign God. And we are a sovereign grace church. Because God is absolutely sovereign. And he said, I see it now. I see it. And a couple weeks later, he said to me, once you see it, you can't unsee it. And he said, and once you see it, it's everywhere. Yeah. Well, there it is. We're just reading along in the second chapter of the book of Deuteronomy. Minding our own business, not doing any harm. Just reading along. And what comes leaping out of this chapter?
Sovereign.
Absolute sovereignty. The sovereignty of a God who can say, don't touch that. You can't have that. If you take that, pay for it. And that over there, that's already yours. Now the people who were there, wipe them out. Now to our human sensibility, that just seems cruel. I mean, there were people who got up that morning, just got up going about their jobs, going about their business, doing their thing, when the armies of Israel came down on them and started wiping them all out. And to our way of thinking, that just seems unfair. What did those people do? Until you understand that God told Abraham that his descendants were going to go into the land of Egypt for 400 years and become a great number of people while in Egypt because the iniquity of the Amorites was not yet full. So God gave them 400 years to build up their guilt and then brought his people down on them to wipe them out for their guilt, which God allowed to grow to its full fruition. Sovereign, sovereign, sovereign.
Grace and justice.
Grace and justice. And so that God, that's the God we're dealing with. Same God who did this with Israel is the same God we're dealing with today. How many times have you heard me say that here on Wednesday nights as we've gone through these first five books of the Bible? If you come away with nothing else from these studies, you got to come away with an image of a God who does exactly what he wants to do whenever he wants to do it. And all the people of the earth are in fact reputed as nothing. And no one can stop his hand and no one can ask him what he's doing. He does exactly what he has determined to do in order to demonstrate his power, his authority, his sovereignty, and as Gladys just said, his grace. Nobody gets to say,
"You weren't fair with me."
Nobody gets to say, "You weren't fair with me." None of these people, though it would look on the surface as if they just got up that day and were doing their thing and the armies of Israel came piling in on them. When they stand before God, God will say, 400 years. 400 years your iniquity before me has been building. I was merciful for not wiping you out 400 years ago. But the time came for judgment to be meted out, and he used his people to do it. So is it fair that God's chosen, elected people got that land? Well, yeah, because God had promised that land to them. Is it fair that God took sides with his elect people against the sinners he judged? Yeah, it's completely fair. Did God just play favorites? Yes, God just played favorites. Does God love everybody equally? No, apparently not. He has a special love, a particular love for his people that is different than the love he had for the people that he wiped out. You understand me? I'm only saying one thing tonight. I'm saying sovereign, 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 and he's going to be that way, and nobody can stop him from being that way, and he's going to be that way whether you like it or not, so just be happy that in his sovereignty, he chose to be good to you. Amen. Because he was under no obligation to be good to anybody. So we're glad that our God, who is the judge of all the earth, will do right, and in doing right, he also expresses his love and his kindness and his long-suffering and his gracious election, and I love his gracious election. Or else, I'd be just as guilty as the people he has a long history of wiping out. I prefer the, oh yeah, mercy and grace thing. We hit three very diverse things tonight. We touched on Easter and Resurrection Sunday. What time Saturday?
4:00.
Very good.
3:30.
And then we touched on Matthew 24:34, and then we got through Deuteronomy 2, so it was a jam-packed, fun-filled night. I hope you enjoyed it.
Thank you for joining us for this week's lesson. If you would like more information about Grace Christian Assembly or the teaching of God's sovereign grace, please visit us on the World Wide Web at salvationbygrace.org.